The Business of Seaweed in Maine. Walk along Maine's coast and you will see it everywhere. Seaweed. It's a signature element of Maine's coastal ecosystem, and these days many different types of seaweed are harvested in the wild and farmed for many different uses. Demand for edible seaweeds from the U.S. is growing, and you can find it in more and more restaurants and grocery aisles. But seaweed is good for more than healthy eating. It's a key ingredient of non-food products too, from fertilizers to cosmetics. I'm Fred Bever. Today on the program, we'll examine just how big a business seaweed is in Maine and how big it could become. We'll ask whether the resource can withstand new pressures and just what are the challenges and opportunities for those looking to make a living off of kelp, dulse, and rockweed. Maine Calling explores seaweed's potential for the state's economy. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Fred Bever, and this is Maine Calling. You may think of seaweed as that slimy stuff that you step on at the beach, or maybe it calls to mind the green layer wrapped around rice on a California roll. But here in Maine, seaweed plays so many roles, some of which have economic, environmental, and health benefits for our state, maybe some challenges too. Today, we'll discuss the importance of seaweed here in Maine. With me in our studio, George Seaver. He's vice president of the Maine Seaweed Council and vice president and general manager of Ocean Organics, a rockweed company. Tollef Olson, he's president and co-founder of Ocean's Balance, a company that focuses on aquaculture and wild harvest of seaweeds. Joining us from our Bangor studio is Shep Earhart, president of the Maine Seaweed Council and owner of Maine Coast Sea Vegetables, which has been harvesting edible seaweeds for decades. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Shep, can you hear us okay in Bangor?
I can, loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thanks for joining. Listeners, you can see a video of a Maine seaweed harvester at work on our website, mainecalling.net, or on our Facebook page. And as always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the uses for seaweed in Maine? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Or you can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. So let's start by breaking the seaweed industry down a little bit. Its history can be traced back, I think, centuries, really, when coastal residents on many continents would forage for edible varieties. Experience with that, Tollef? Do you know how it developed worldwide?
Well, it's been going on for millennia. Some of the first farmers I knew of were the Hawaiian royalty. They actually had seaweed gardens 600 or 700 years ago. Since the 1950s, China has probably become the dominant in the aquaculture aspect of the industry, dominant player.
And it's now, I believe, the UN says a $5 billion industry, and we're going to be talking about Maine's attempts to get a slice of that pie. What about here on the coast in Maine? George Seaver, your company farms rockweed. That's a history that goes back a little bit into the early 20th century. Is that right?
Well, it wouldn't be really right to say we farm it.
Harvest it.
Right. It's a wild harvest in the same beds basically year after year. So it approaches mariculture actually is one of the ways we think about it because we're so responsible to those beds. But yeah, we've been doing rockweed. I've been doing it since 1977. There's a couple of businesses in Waldoboro where the rockweed is processed, and there's one in Brunswick where it's either dehydrated into a feed supplement or a soil amendment, or there's a liquid extract you could make from it that's got great agricultural significance.
How did that come about? How did the developments of, you know, it's we see rockweed every time we go to the Maine coast. It's that seaweed that's there clamped onto the intertidal rocks. How did it come into these kinds of uses?
I think it's clear that people have been harvesting it to put on their gardens to make the soils better as long as there have been people with gardens. Usually it's been cast seaweed in that case, and the people who owned the shorefront owned that washed up seaweed. So it's a natural evolution to make a commercialized product out of something that people knew was good. The liquid extract side of it is a little bit different in that you're getting different properties from the seaweed, but it's also a logical extension of what people used to do and still do next to their gardens, where you would have a barrel with some water and some seaweed in it and maybe some ashes, and you make your own tea for your garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they discovered years ago, many centuries ago, that these mixtures did much more than they understood in terms of improving plant growth. And the extracts we make are the commercial extension of that discovery.
Shep Earhart, your company, Maine Coast Sea Vegetables, you've been going for about 40 years now. Is that right? What got you into the business?
Let's see. I think you'd say that it was necessity. My wife and I were eating seaweed from Japan back in the early 70s, and it was expensive and came from far away. So we started looking around at a more local source, and sure enough, it's growing abundantly. Not rockweed. Well, rockweed is growing abundantly, but rockweed actually tastes pretty bitter.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking for more of the culinary seaweeds, I call them, ones that actually have a more amenable taste. And we found some malaria, and then eventually some form of kelp, and eventually some dults, and some wild nori or porphyra. So those four were the basis of our little company, Maine Coast Sea Veggies. And we, you know, would tell our friends, gee, it's some great seaweeds up here. And pretty soon we had, by word of mouth, a little business grew into a very big business. I'd say it's a big little business.
A big little business, as we are a big little state. You dry the seaweeds that you market mostly.
Yes, we dried ours. The trick is, you know, seaweed, if you pull it out of the water, you've got about 24 hours before it starts decomposing in some way, and you lose some of its nutrients. So one of the ways of preserving those nutrients are to dry them. And that's, you know, more labor intensive perhaps than other people have salted them down in a fresh state. In Europe, they've tried that, and in Asia. I know there's a company, Ocean Approved, who freezes their seaweed to preserve its nutrients. And there may be new areas of exploration now to preserve seaweed's nutrients in other ways. I hope there will be.
And now you've primarily harvested wild seaweed, but you're moving into aquaculture as well. Is that right?
We are. We see that, you know, aquaculture seaweeds have all the nutrients, and it's much more easy to harvest. Obviously, you choose your time. It's beneficial to the to the ecosystem, because they are they're good scavengers of excess nitrogen, excess phosphorus, other elements in the water column. They grow very compatibly with shellfish or finfish, helping to mitigate some of the excess that those organisms produce. So it's a good symbiotic relationship, and basically we see it as a good improvement of, you know, the water quality in our bays by growing more seaweeds. And it helps supplement our wild crop, which it's time to do that. I think it's time to have both available, both wild and cultured.
And we can talk a little bit more about that question of just what the wild crop can sustain and what the potential of farming is. But you mentioned Ocean Approved a minute ago. Talif Olson, I believe you helped to start that company.
That's correct. I founded the Ocean Approved and the frozen line of products. I saw a lot of opportunity other than the dried seaweeds. It's a market that the Chinese have dominated for a long time now. They grow as much as 15 million metric tons annually. And so I was looking at new product lines, and also at Ocean Approved started the first farm in the United States for aquacultured seaweeds and kelps. Now at Ocean's Balance, we're following up on that, and we're learning to propagate new species. We're also developing new product lines. I think that's part of the key to this industry to be commercially viable in the state, is to continue to develop new product lines. As George said, he's working with some components for agriculture. Shep's been doing a wonderful job with the dried for years at Ocean Approved, came up with a beautiful frozen product. And I think that is what we need to really grow this industry, is to be innovative. We're looking at cosmetics. We're looking at pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals, plastics, fuels, bioremediation. The list goes on and on and on. There are so many benefits to the from the seaweed industry, aquaculture, and wild harvest. As George said, the majority of the wild harvest in this state is conducted using mariculture techniques, which mean you use the proper husbandry to ensure the longevity of the beds.
Well, now, the edible product is having a bit of a moment in the media and in culinary circles, particularly in Maine, but also in New York and other taste-making centers, if you will. I visited with some folks at in Walpole, Maine Fresh Sea Farms, which is bringing fresh product to market into restaurants. How important is this moment for the industry? I mean, you guys are all pioneers in the early development of what's really probably the biggest U.S.-based seaweed industry here in Maine. It seems to, it certainly in the media and in some culinary circles, it's having a moment where it's getting renewed public attention. Tastes are expanding. Certainly on the expansion of Asian cuisine into America has probably helped that. Is this a moment when the industry really could take a leap forward?
I believe so, and it's much more than just the culinary delights. You have to look also at the nutritional values. 50% of the people in this country are iodine deficient. About a teaspoon or a tablespoon of most seaweed products are going to cover that deficiency. 90% of the people in this country are magnesium deficient. You look at other things like if you look at the FAO branch of the United Nations, they've stated that we cannot feed the projected population past about 2050 with our farm model. It's broken. We're going to be out of mineable phosphates by 2050. We have to move to the ocean for nutrients, for food. The fact that it's a culinary delight is just a huge bonus.
I'm going to remind our listeners the number to call if you want to join this conversation about seaweed, its delights, and perhaps some of its opportunities to be a growth sector in Maine's economy. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Shep Earhart at the Maine Seaweed Council, you've mentioned that I think we had a conversation a little while ago that in fact it's becoming more difficult to find enough. Is it enough farm product to meet demand?
No.
Okay.
Enough wild product. Some species. We've had some challenges with some of the kelps. One of the kelps in particular. And adults and the wild nori, the demand definitely. I mean, you know, we are committed to sustainably harvesting. We're committed to going back year after year to the same beds. As George said, it's really more like a, you know, we're tending these beds, and we don't want to overdo them. We want to make sure we can get the same amount every year, but the demand is growing for those species, and that's part of why we're moving into aquaculture, because we can supplement what we can't get from the wild.
Well, that could be a good evidence then that this really could be an opportunity for the state of Maine, given the resource here, given the clarity of its waters, given the energy of people like yourselves. Was there a sort of turning point in this demand? You mentioned one time to me the nuclear accident at Fukushima in Japan. Has there really been a noticeable change in consumer desire for these products from the U.S. specifically?
Very definitely, Fred. After Fukushima, I think people realized not only was seaweed a great nutrient source, but it actually, of course, if you're considering radioactive poisoning, it's one of the primary remediators of that due to its high iodine content that helps supplement the radioactive iodine in the thyroid. Plus, it has these remarkable polysaccharides, these alginates and fucoidins. Alginates in particular will actually sequester some of the radioactive materials like strontium-90. There's some good science and how that happens. And the brown seaweeds particularly are rich in this algenic acid that will help with radioactive poisoning and the remediation of it. So a lot of people turn to seaweed just instinctively or because they'd read about it. And I think they've never turned back. We've just considered seeing more demand every year.
Now, the vast amount of landings of seaweed in Maine is actually rockweed, the product that's used for fertilizer and agricultural products, a much smaller portion, but growing portion is on the edible side. Do we have any data that actually tell, you know, you guys see it anecdotally that your markets are growing, you're seeing the potential. Do we have access to any data that actually measures that in any way? George Seaver.
The Department of Marine Resources tracks landings. You have to report, and they've been more diligent about it since about 2008. But yeah, if you land material, you report it to DMR. And yes, we do know. About 97% of the landings are rockweed, Escaphyllum, the agricultural type of products. you asked a few minutes ago about the are we in a moment, and I was all I could do to be quiet because in the last 40 years, these extracts, these agricultural extracts, have gone from being considered snake oil, although they were using them in Europe for decades before that.
Mm-hmm.
They were considered snake oil. They were like, what could this possibly be? And the moment you refer to is basically the last 15 years. The agricultural producers, agricultural industry has come to recognize these materials as bona fide supplements that really make your fertilizer work better. You get more food per acre. You don't use as many pesticides. It's an absolute product category now. And in fact, I was I've been at conferences around lately, and Europe is probably 5 years ahead of us in terms of its regulations and recognition of these materials, these extracts, as a real valuable tool in future food production.
Is there potential and interest in reducing reliance on petroleum-based products? Is that part of what's going on?
Well, it's part of it. If you'd asked me 10 years ago how seaweed extract works, I would have given you a great answer. The more we learn about it, the less sure we are of exactly what it's doing, in all candor. But what we do know from testing it and, you know, spending money on research trials around the state and country is that you do get these increases in efficiency of the materials you're using. So it's interesting. If you talk to somebody growing potatoes and say, I can get you the same potatoes with less fertilizer if you use my product, he will say, let me use your product, and I'll use the same fertilizer and get more potatoes. This is like psychology of fertilizer reduction is a little tricky, but
I see.
But you do reduce the need for pesticides in many cases, and fertilizer if you choose to, but ultimately get more crops.
Thank you, George. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, listeners. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
This week, Democrats will meet in Philadelphia to nominate Hillary Clinton for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night of the convention. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill as we take you inside the arena and to the floor of the Democratic National Convention. It's special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Full coverage tonight through Thursday evening this week, starting at 8 on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television.
I'm Renee Montaigne. Every night at midnight, I drive my 30-year-old sedan to NPR West to host Morning Edition. There are some benefits to keeping crazy hours, for instance, no traffic jams and plenty of parking. There's nothing like a trusty car to get you where you're going, but when you're ready to part with it, did you know that you can turn your car into the programs you love? Donate it to us. Here's how.
You can visit mpbn.net and click on the red donate button at the top right-hand side.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Fred Bever. Today on the program, the role of seaweed in Maine's economy. With us in the studio, George Seaver. He's vice president of the Maine Seaweed Council and vice president and general manager of Ocean Organics. Tolliff Olson, he's president and co-founder This is his latest company now. Oceans Balance, a company that focuses on aquaculture and wild harvest of seaweeds. And joining us from a Bangor studio is Shep Earhart, president of the Maine Seaweed Council. And he's also the owner of Maine Coast Sea Vegetables. We invite you to join the conversation, and we'll be getting to your calls in a minute. The number to call is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. But on the line with us now is Robin Hadlock-Seeley. We've turned to her because we've been talking a lot about the economic potential. There's also perhaps some risk, some challenge in protecting the resource, and this is something that Robin Hadlock-Seeley has been paying attention to. She's the academic coordinator and senior research associate with the Shoals Marine Laboratory. She's also an eighth-generation Mainer. Robin, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Oh, thank you very much, and hi to Shep and George and Tola.
So, Robin, as seaweed has been showing new potential in Maine's economy, you've been raising concerns about protecting what are known as habitat-forming seaweeds. Can you explain to us just what is a habitat-forming seaweed and why it's important?
Well, yeah, so far we've been talking a lot about the brown seaweeds and their use in agriculture and for fertilizer. But some of these seaweeds are also what we call the habitat-forming seaweeds, which means instead of being the small seaweeds that sort of are underfoot when you're walking on the shore, these are the seaweeds that form underwater forests at high tide. And listeners may be familiar with the California kelp forests that a lot of people have seen pictures of that grow so to such a great height. That's a habitat-forming brown seaweed. And we don't have the California kelp forests in Maine, obviously. But in Maine, our underwater forest seaweeds are the true kelps and the rockweed. And as George mentioned, it's the rockweed that forms about 90 to 97% of all the seaweed landed in Maine. So it's a concern.
And we've talked a little bit about pressure on the wild edible resource. But it's not highly regulated at this point. Does the industry, gentlemen, I throw this to you as well as to you, Robin, does the industry need some new regulation to help it through this phase of growth? George Seaver.
Yes, there was. No, it doesn't, because we've sort of been doing that. The Maine Seaweed Council was formed back in the 90s before Department of Marine Resources was really thinking very much about our seaweed businesses. To basically preemptively establish some criteria for harvesting and how to behave on the water responsibly or on the intertidal zone. Way back then, we established a cutting height and the practical realities of how much you can harvest and keep going back to that to the areas near your factory. You don't want to have to go too far for your seaweed, so you're very careful with what you do within driving distance. But so at some point anyway, the Department of Marine Resources became involved and there was a group assembled to produce a fisheries management plan for rockweed where we, and Robin was at many of the meetings, where we looked at how best to do it based on the science of the plants and the practical experience we'd had, keeping in mind that we've been harvesting this in mid-coast Maine anyway. For 40 years, these same beds have been returned to year after year or repeatedly.
Yeah, but that points out an important difference between our interpretations, and this difference comes up over and over again, and George won't be surprised what I'm going to say, but the measure, the yardstick for sustainability is not how much biomass is coming back year after year. You cut it, let it grow, cut it, let it grow, cut it, let it grow. The yardstick, I would argue, is an ecological sustainability yardstick for this species because it forms habitat that are important. That's important to so many different types of organisms, from cod and herring, lobsters, you know, shorebirds, seabirds, waders. All of these organisms are using this habitat. So the yardstick cannot be how much comes back after we cut it and how soon can we go and cut it again. The yardstick has to be what is the ecological sustainability of cutting it. At what point does the function of the rockweed forest become degraded?
George Seaver, a quick answer to that, and then I think we should, this is going to be an ongoing argument, I think, and something that we will come back to on Maine Public Radio News, but just a quick response.
I think that the reality of the scale of our operation becomes central to the discussion. Based on University of Maine and different people you talk to at different times, there's probably a million wet tons of rockweed along the Maine coast. And the most that's ever been harvested is about, I think, 8,500 tons. There's more of it that turns over naturally because of ice and wave action. There's probably 30 times more is turned over naturally than we've ever harvested. The point being that in the sense of the impact on the other creatures that might be living or need the seaweed to survive, we're in the 1% of the resource range. And at that, we're leaving the bottom 16 inches in all cases.
Then there shouldn't be any problem with having conservation areas, and that's what I'm most interested in. A lot of other people are most interested in it, is getting these no-cut conservation areas protected so that there is a place where shorebirds don't have to worry about being driven out, where there is a place where juvenile cod can thrive. That's been the biggest problem over the last, say, year, is getting a consensus on even having conservation areas, let alone where they should be.
Robin, thanks for joining us today. And we will be watching that issue. We'll be watching the Department of Marine Resources to see what kind of material, whether it's data or regulatory policies that might affect this. There's some court cases coming up. I want to ask a similar question, though, about pressure on the wild edible resource. Talif Olson, you're experimenting with new varieties. Shep has talked about pressure on the wild resource. Is farming the future for edible seaweed? Is it a silver bullet that can not only take pressure off of the wild resource, but also create some of these conservation and ecological benefits that Robin Hadlock-Seeley was talking about with the subsurface seaweeds?
Absolutely. The opportunity here is fantastic. Every time we put in a seaweed bed, even if it's a laminaria that's only going to be in for the winter, we have interaction with the local flora and fauna, and they take opportunities of it. It's like putting artificial reefs in place, and it also does augment and supplement the existing natural beds, which gives us a good alternative. Another neat thing about the farming is we really grow a beautiful, consistent product. And as the pressure increases and more people become involved with seaweeds, it means that we preemptively moved in a direction as an industry to cover those bases. As George said, only 1% of the beds right now are being hit. If you look at the 1% of the volume is being utilized in the rockweeds. If you look at something like what's going on out on Cassius Ledge and with some of our offshore protected areas now, it's taken centuries and the resource was decimated ahead of time. The beauty of the seaweed industry is we are absolutely ahead of the curve, and the economic opportunities, the socioeconomic benefits that we're going to see are just huge. Shep's company has been employing 30 or 40 people, I believe. Shep could verify that, for 40 years now. I'm not sure how many George employs, and we've got so many other companies doing that. A great example would be the large carrageenan producing company in this state who from, I think it was 1934 to 1970, used local seaweeds. And then in 1970, they went overseas. The Philippines created 1 million jobs in seaweed aquaculture. We have 1.2 million people in this state. I don't think we need 1 million jobs.
Well, we've got one who's involved in the industry and who wants to talk about innovation happening. David in Rockland, can you join us? And please, what do you got to tell us about the industry and its growth here in Maine?
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're right on the air. Go right ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Fred. Good afternoon, Tolos, George, Shep, from my accent.
Hi, David.
You know who I am.
I see smiles around here. Yeah.
I am an independent consultant. My company, Great Sea Vegetables, provides services to the local and international seaweed company. And I see a bright future for the seaweed, sea vegetables market in Maine. One item I agree and one that I slightly disagree. I agree with Tolov. Innovation has been the block. Sea veggies, dry sea veggies in a plastic sack, they don't look tasty. The product is tasty. The product is nice. But I totally agree with Tolov. We are missing the innovation. Somebody mentioned Europe. Sea veggies should be looked as just another seafood. And that's what they are to me. They are seafood. So in that area, we have a lot to grow somebody freezes them, somebody sells them fresh, you can salt them, you can pickle, you can integrate them into the other product. So that's an area for growth. The one that I slightly disagree is the pressure on the natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
Already mentioned, rockweed, we are under 1% of harvest of what's out there. With kelps and another species, we have to look at them individually. Nori, laver, regardless the name, what the Japanese use to roll their sushi. Maine is not the natural place for large quantities. It would be like trying to grow pineapples or mangoes in Maine. I don't think that's going to happen. Dolls, I would agree with Shep, we are probably close to what we can harvest because the large beds are in the northern part of the Gulf of Maine. But if you look at kelp, we have a huge amount of kelp, natural kelp that you can go out and forage it. You can harvest it every single day of the year as long as the weather permits. Make the association what the French call the terrarium, the different type of wine, the different type of farms that you have depending on microclimate. Exactly the same happened with the kelp. You can go to a ledge, you move several miles, you go to a different bay, you get a different kelp, different taste, different texture.
Do you call that miroir? Is there a word for, for that kind of particular?
They call it the terrarium. I call it the oceanarium. I don't have a word.
The oceanarium.
Let me just close.
Please.
I don't know the harvest numbers, how many harvesters we have in Maine. I know that there is one person that takes, his name, he lives in Steuben, Lars Hansen. He takes in apprentices. He teaches them how to do it. His only request for them is not to harvest close to his place. And that will be the way of expanding and getting more young people, young fishermen into the market. But just figure out how many harvesters, how many licenses we have in the state of Maine, and just measure the miles of ocean, of islands, of ledges that we have in Maine. So we still have long, long ways to go before we really put the negative pressure on the seaweed resources of Maine. And in closing, we have a very, very bright future. We just have to work together and see what we can achieve in the next 5 to 10 years.
David, thanks very much for your call. I'd like to go to another call before our next break. And this gets to a question of, David was just talking about getting young people involved. And I think a lot of people might go, oh, seaweed, that sounds neat. I might be a lobsterman. I might be a fin fisherman. I might be a young farmer, a land-based farmer. How on earth do I get into this? And Matt from Bangor, you seem to have a question along these lines. Please join the conversation.
I do, as a matter of fact. Thank you. My first question is, I would like to understand the basics of seaweed agriculture. How do they grow? What do you do to make things grow? And the other question that came up when I was listening to Robin is looking at the history we've had in the state of urchin fisheries and the now elver fisheries. What's the science about, making sure that this is sustainable across 10, 20, 30, 50 years?
It's a good point. We can look at sea urchin. We can look at scallops. We can look at Maine shrimp. We can look at cod. We can see a lot of fisheries that have been overexploited. So that's one thing to look at. But first, propagation. You guys share a lot around that, don't you?
Well, the whole key to aquaculture is seed source. And to go with the urchin industry and boom and bust cycles with fisheries in the past, I've been involved in several and didn't like what I saw as I grew up. That's why I love the seaweed industry and the preemptive strikes we've been taking. But I also like moving into the aquaculture, and not only for the not taking pressure off the natural resource. In aquaculture, we can come up with a much more uniform product. And it's also an easier way for young people or other people that want to move into the industry to enter than it is to just go and start wild harvesting. Tides, weather, all the different things that we deal with in the wild harvest it can be difficult if you're not a fisherman already. The farming opens up opportunities for people who can't get lobster licenses, for lobster fishers who want to earn extra income in the wintertime. But it still all comes back to the innovation and development of new products, new markets. If we all chase the same small existing market, we're going to have a hard time growing this industry. So the innovative side of it is really going to be the key.
Well, and when we come back from our break, I want to continue along those themes and talk about support, infrastructure. What are the resources, marketing plans? What are the resources the industry needs to seize this moment? We are going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Maine people protecting the nature of Maine now more than ever. Learn more at nrcm.org.
Hi, this is Erwin Gratz, your Morning Edition host here at Maine Public Radio. Morning Edition has always brought you the top news stories and developments of the day, and now Maine Public Radio with the BBC NewsHour, Diane Rehm Live, On Point, and Here and Now continues that coverage right throughout the morning. Maine Public Radio is now living up to its potential on the music side, too, with Maine Public Classical. But it's all only possible with your support. Our one-day Super Thursday campaign is just ahead, August 4th. Keep your public radio strong by making a call or pledge online anytime from right now through the end of the day, August 4th. mpbn.net is where to pledge online if you listen and count on Maine Public Radio. Thanks.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker, Larry Brilliant, chair of Skoll Global Threats, which fights Zika and other pandemics. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Bever, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what's the business potential for seaweed from Maine? With me in our studio, George Seaver. He's president of the Maine Seaweed Council, vice president of the Maine Seaweed Council and vice president and general manager of Ocean Organics. Tollef Olson, he's president and co-founder of Ocean's Balance, a company that focuses on aquaculture and wild harvest of seaweeds. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Shep Earhart. He's the president of the Maine Seaweed Council and owner of Maine Coast Sea Vegetables. I'd like to bring in on the phone to join a conversation about support for this industry and structures and infrastructure to Hugh, who's calling from Coastal Enterprises in Portland. Hugh, please join the conversation.
Great, thank you. Basically, Coastal Enterprises is a community development organization located here in Maine, and we've supported the fishing industry and aquaculture industry for about 40 years. And we see the sea vegetable industry as a really tremendous opportunity for Maine. So the wild harvesters to processors, farm-raised production, and as the panel has noted, the value-added opportunities. Because, you know, our wild fish stocks are challenged, and we're seeing declines in soft-shell clams and shrimp and groundfish and sea urchins. And, you know, we have a lot of fishermen on the Maine coast, and they're very reliant on the lobster industry. And that's a pretty vulnerable position to be in. So these fishermen are set up with vessels and gear, and they have the seamanship skills. And farm production of sea vegetables, you know, could create this new opportunity for these fishermen to help diversify income. And a lot of the grow-out occurs during the winter months from November through May, when traditionally fishermen would be, you know, chasing shrimp and scallops and sea urchins. So We very much support this industry.
Well, and there are interesting complementary things that can go on. For instance, Tollef Olson, your former company, Ocean Approved, recently expanded to a new processing facility that during the summer months is used for land-based vegetable harvest packing, but in the winter is going to move over to packing seaweed. So that's frozen seaweed. So that's, you know, a nice synergy there. This is an opportunity for people who are experienced with the seagoing economy and seagoing ways. This is something that can add, that can take advantage of that resource that we have in Maine. George Seaver, you see a particular opportunity for adding value to Maine's economy?
Yeah, the rockweed, the agricultural products, and again specifically these extracts, it's different than other fisheries. And what I mean by that is that you can go harvest some seaweed, but if you don't have anybody to process it, you've got a pile of seaweed. Or clams, if you get clams, somebody will buy them. So the point I'm trying to make is that it's all about the processing. And rockweed in particular and these agricultural products is, I think it may be, if not the most, not the best fishery for adding value in state, it's got to be close. It doesn't take a lot of dollars worth of harvested seaweed to run a business. And the in terms of the trajectory of the last 40 years, it used to be that the hardest thing to do was to find someone to buy it. And then now, the products, now we're in busy, busy production. For the past 5 years, we've been right out straight in the spring. But getting the seaweed has never been the limiting factor. It's always been adding the value to it, processing it better and better, competing internationally with other people who are processing it. But it's a unique fishery in the sense that it's completely process-driven, not harvest-driven.
Is there good support in the state for developing those infrastructures for new processes, for transport, for storage? CEI, I think, is involved in some of that. We just spoke to Coastal Enterprises. NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is seeding projects around Maine and elsewhere in the country. What kind of support is there? What kind is needed? Is it, venture capital? Is it showing up for these enterprises? Any of you guys?
Well, what we run into in that, and I want to put in a plug for CEI here. CEI took a risk when I started the Bangs Island Mussels. CEI came in when I started Ocean Approved. CEI has a history of coming in early. NOAA SBIR helped out in the early research. The early research was difficult. When I first started talking about this project in the 1990s, people were like, farm seaweed? New seaweed products? We don't need that. The internet, the advent of the internet and the new generations coming up and past generations, people are really realizing the value of farm products from the ocean, value-added products, and it's really important that we build seaweed into this stream. And now is the time, and people are aware of it. And so, yes, the infrastructure is difficult at first. When I first went to a bank and said I was going to grow something in the ocean, they laughed at me and said, well, we've never financed that, and we're not going to start. That's when I went to CEI. And so these institutions are important to us, the same with venture capital. I approached a venture capital firm in 2009, and they said, well, nobody's ever grown seaweed in Maine. This is changing rapidly as the industry matures and people are seeing the demand that we're creating by being innovative and moving forward with new products.
Shep Earhart, I want to bring you back into the conversation. As you have, like our other guests, seen demand grow, as you have expanded your capacity, what is it like finding the financial resources and other resources, just the actual ability to get your product to market?
First, I want to be clear. I'm a slow growth advocate.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate the role of venture capital and large infusions of cash, but generally I've grown my business very slowly, and I think there's some sustainability in slow growth that may not be there in larger leaps. I am involved and have been getting support from several different projects, infrastructure-based projects, particularly around drying, since drying is the technology that I would like to see evolve. We're still drying using the same technology I was using 40 years ago, i.e. clothespins and hanging pieces of kelp up like laundry on a line. That needs to change. And this past winter, I was involved in one drying project that we need to work on more. And I've been involved in a couple other through MTI grants. And the university is working with us also.
I'm sorry, that's the Maine Technology Institute. Is that right?
Yes,
okay,
Maine
I'm
Technology
sorry,
Institute.
Please go ahead.
Been very helpful with their seed grants. The university has been helping, trying to get some more cost effectiveness into the drying process. I also am very interested in processes that I've seen in Europe where they take fresh seaweed and apply salt at various concentrations to it and extend the shelf life for months. That's very effective and fairly inexpensive. You have to refrigerate your product, but the actual process is fairly inexpensive to complete. So I think more innovation there, but I'm definitely looking at this. You know, we have a lease now in Frenchman's Bay to grow seaweed, which we share, by the way, to talk to Hugh's point. We share with a local lobsterman who is very interested also in seaweed, not only to supplement his income, but he has a son, and he rightfully looks forward and says, we never know about lobsters, but I think seaweed's going to be here forever. So, you know, he's thinking ahead. We're all thinking ahead. And in order to make this work, though, we need to make sure we have a place to stabilize the seaweed once we grow it. It's pretty easy to grow. It's harder to get it to market in a stable form that still has its nutrient values and that people can easily and readily use. So that is a challenge. And I believe over the next few years, we will figure out more effective ways of drying, more effective ways of perhaps pickling, salting, freezing. I think Tollef's working on a whole nother process, which I'm not sure we can talk about. I think it's proprietary, but innovation definitely is needed. And money is out there. It seems like there are, I just went to my bank and actually was welcomed by my bank to expand our facility. We just put ourselves in a new 18,000 square foot processing facility in expectations of the advent of aquacultured seaweed becoming much more available, and we wanted to be ready for that.
Are you adding jobs along with that?
Yes, we added some jobs. We're now up to 20 full-time people in our facility. We just added two positions this spring, and we may hope to add more. And the bank saw that and felt we were a good risk. So things have changed a little bit since Tollef went to the bank, I believe.
There's a gentleman on the line now, Sebastian, of the Maine Aquaculture Association. And if I can bring him up, Sebastian, you have some advice about getting into the seaweed business.
Well, I want to start by commending you guys for picking the three people that you did to be on your show. These are three of a small group of visionaries in Maine who have really pioneered the development of this sector and are kind of on the edge of taking it to the next level. So, kudos to you for picking the folks you have on the show. I just was listening in earlier, and there was a young man, I think, from Bangor who asked a question about how a young person could learn more about seaweed farming and or kind of get into the business. And I wanted to just highlight a program which has been going on now for 4 or 5 years in Maine. Hugh Copperthwaite, who called in earlier from CI, is also a part of it. And it's started as an aquaculture training academy and has morphed into a shellfish and seaweed training academy. We run it as a cooperation between Sea Grant, CEI, and the Maine Aquaculture Association, with a few other folks who come in and out of the program on an annual basis. And it's designed to train people who really know very little about aquaculture, whether it's seaweed or shellfish, on the basics of how to become a farmer. And I would encourage anybody who is listening and is interested in the program, give us a call at the Maine Aquaculture Office, 622-0136. We'd be glad to put you on the list of folks for the next academy. It's a cool academy. It runs for between 16 and 18 weeks. It's free, and we try and give everybody the basics, both from a business point of view to a biology to an aquaculture to a farm management perspective.
Gentlemen, is the industry ready for that kind of influx of knowledge and workers? As I started out at this show saying, $5 billion industry internationally. Most of our seaweed in the U.S. is imported.
We are getting to the point where we're ready. It's still a little bit in the early stages, but that's really growing rapidly. In today's technology, things move a lot faster than they used to, but it's still going to come down to innovation. I know we've used that word many times today, but that is what's going to drive and has driven this industry to the growth it already has. The multipliers involved in this industry, though, are incredible also, not just the direct participants, but all the infrastructure that this helps support. As the other beleaguered fishing industries kind of slowly die off or mature, there are a lot of industry participants where we buy our line, our buoys, our boats. People underestimate the multiplier effect, and that's a lot of the jobs also. I'm a consultant down at the University of New England, and the focus isn't just on the farmers or just the end product. It's also on all the peripheral jobs and potential products.
I'm not sure what to compare it to for potential growth in Maine. There is a lot of interest in pharmaceuticals. There is a lot of interest in various coastal enterprises. This could seem to sort of be a component of almost all of them.
The agricultural products are internationally, they've been on a, well, when they stopped being snake oil and started being a bona fide amendment, supplement, it's a nice trajectory. I mean, I'm comfortable with it in this, particularly in our business, where a lot of what we do is add value. We're adding bells and whistles to our extracts to be competitive. I see no chance of having a problem with the amount of seaweed we need. In terms of the infrastructure, as long as the roads are open and the ramps are clear, we're pretty good.
Shep Earhart, you've talked about about sustainability and slow growth. You're the president of the Seaweed Council. Do you expect that as these markets continue to progress, that there will continue to be some tension between the advocates of growth and people wanting to sort of make a splash and really get into the business and ramp up quickly, and pressure on the resource? Is that going to be an ongoing conversation in this industry?
Exactly. I believe it will be an ongoing conversation, and there will be tension. Growth always includes tension. That's part of the natural makeup. And I believe, you know, right now there are people who feel like we're moving too fast, actually, that we're ahead of ourselves in terms of piquing interest where we don't have actual product. And I, in terms of agriculture product, I believe that's true. We really have a lot more interest in growing than we do right now in actually marketable product.
Shep, I'm going to
ways to get to market.
I'm going to stop you there because we are out of time. Clearly a conversation that will be a great interest to continue into the future. Shep, George Tolliffe, thank you all for joining us today. Shep Earhart is president of the Maine Seaweed Council. George Seaver is vice president. Tolliffe Olson is president and co-founder of Oceans Balance. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Wednesday on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about new developments in limb regeneration. Keith will speak to two Maine researchers who are making significant progress in that new and important field. I'm Fred Bever, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.